This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Science and religion have been pitted against one another for centuries. Galileo versus the Catholic Church in the 1600s, Darwin's theology-shaking theory of evolution in the 1800s. That's just a couple of times when science and religion have clashed. And while science is defined by clear methodologies and peer-reviewed findings, religion is at once abstract and highly personal. But whether or not someone is a devout Hindu priest or a Nobel-winning neuroscientist, both wield tools in search of greater understanding. And they both work toward what my guest today would call a universal search for meaning. Jeff Polish is the founder and executive director of the Monty, a nonprofit storytelling organization. This Friday, the Monty teams up with the Museum of Life and Science and the Carolina Theater to feature stories at the intersection of medicine and religion. Jeff Polish, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have really done it this time, Jeff. Oh,
thank you.
Sometimes you talk about Sometimes you talk about politics. Now you're talking about religion and science. But give me an idea about the genesis for this. There's a story behind that.
Right? Yeah. So the Museum of Life and Science approached me about doing a program revolving around the relationship between medicine and religion, and I would not have agreed to do it had I not taught a class with Ray Barfield and Deborah Jensen in the spring at Duke called Storytelling in Medicine and Health. And when I was enlisted to teach that course, I was like, oh, I'm going to help to teach physicians how to, you know, increase their narrative knowledge and to be able to talk to their patients and listen to their stories. And then on the very first day of class, Ray Barfield stands up, my co-teacher, and he is a physician, and he starts talking about, you know, medicine and how when physicians are looking at patients, what they're also seeing are molecular interactions, chemical bonds, and some that are supposed to happen, some that are a result of a defect that are causing a disease. And that's what they're analyzing in many cases. And yet on the other side of it is the patient who is not thinking about the molecular mechanisms. They're thinking about, why is this happening to me? And, you know, many who have religion in their lives can draw from that framework to find meaning. But those who don't have religion in their lives are still searching for meaning. And those meanings may not adhere to the laws of physics. They are mystical and otherworldly, and they are spiritual in nature.
Well, maybe we just haven't pushed our physics far enough, but that's a subject for another Monty,
right.
I suppose. But you really so you're going to bring these two together in one, because you've talked about religion before,
mm-hmm,
and so
right.
You've talked about medicine and medical crises and all of those. Was this different for you because you do a lot of coaching and a lot of curating of these stories and kind of looking for stories? Was it different for you in looking for people to be part of this?
Well, there are a couple of differences. Number one is that I couldn't curate this show without really making sure that I was representing not just one religion, but various religions. And also, what I learned is that no matter what the backgrounds of the storytellers with whom I was working, we're all more alike than we are different. We're all searching for the same thing, and we're seeking peace and understanding, no matter what our religious ideology is.
Well, you brought a couple of clips here to share from past Montys that will help us sort of get into the right frame of mind for this. Maybe you can set up the first one with Erin Duffy.
Sure. So Erin Duffy tells a story about her child who was diagnosed and subsequently treated for leukemia. And this is a classic story about a family's fear and anger and finally a search for understanding and meaning in this crisis.
She had 28 months of chemo, 11 hospitalizations, some of them quite long, countless trips to the ER and the pediatric cancer clinic. It was a grueling time. During that time, people would often say things to me, the kinds of things that people say when someone's having a hard time. God won't send you anything you can't handle. Everything happens for a reason. This is part of God's plan. Sometimes these things were not especially helpful. sometimes they were even a little irritating. But I have to say, every time anyone said anything like that, I knew what they were really saying was, I really care about you and your family, and I just am not sure what to say. So I always tried to hear that. Embry finished treatment in May of 2014. We spent 1 year going back to the clinic every month for blood work. Then we graduated to going every 2 months for blood work. We had just graduated to every 3 months this past June when we had the devastating news that she had relapsed. It was awful. It was the worst day of our lives. We felt tired and depleted and like we were starting a long, hard trip with a quarter tank of gas. And frankly, we are pissed. Dennis and Embry and I and our other daughters, I mean, what the f***? We did everything right. We have done this. We have learned whatever lesson we are supposed to learn. And yet, here we are. Since June, she has spent more than 80 nights in the hospital. She's responding very well to her treatments, and we are very hopeful. But we still have a lot ahead of us, and we will never again be seduced by statistics. And Embry's older. She was 11 when she relapsed. She just turned 12. She has harder questions. She understands what's at stake. She asks these questions. If God loves me so much, why did this happen? What did I do to deserve this? If God can do anything, why am I not healed immediately from cancer? Will I die? What is heaven like? It is heartbreaking to have your 11-year-old child ask you these questions. And we've spent many nights in the hospital, in our PJs, in her bed, in the dark, talking about these questions. I try, and I think I probably fail, to answer them. And I'm trying for myself as much as I'm trying for her.
That is Erin Duffy telling her story at the Monty, a nonprofit storytelling organization. I'm joined by the founder and executive director of the Monty, Jeff Polish, as we talk about the next Monty, which looks at the intersection of faith and medicine. And certainly there is an example of someone who had to navigate both of those worlds and find this collision that maybe she hadn't seen coming.
Absolutely. And by the end of the story, she finds her own version of faith and God in her life, and it becomes very profound and meaningful. But we're all searching for something out there.
We'll set up the second one for us, Jody Oakley, because here's another story in a different way that that also informs this topic.
Right. So Jody has dedicated, you know, in her early years, dedicated her life to her Christianity. She lived by the teachings of God. She talked about it. She blogged about it frequently. And all of that was in play until one moment where everything changed, where she was in an accident.
And I do remember opening my eyes and seeing a man staring into my face with lots of worry in his face. And I didn't recognize him, but it would turn out to be the guide that had driven us there only hours before. But I felt fine, and I was refusing to go to the hospital. And then finally they asked me the classic question that you should ask anybody that you think has a head injury. They said, what is today? And I knew what today was because that was a fact. That was a thing that I knew and a thing that I believed. And I very confidently said, today is Tuesday. And when they told me it was Thursday, I burst into tears because nothing that I knew for sure could be trusted anymore. So they took me to the hospital, and they did an x-ray, which I now know does very little to assess actual brain damage. But they did look at the bones in my face and told me I was physically fine and just to take it easy. So we would return to South Africa and things would seem normal after that. Later that week, someone would ask me if I wanted to go to church, and I said yes, because I always said yes when someone asked me to go to church, but I really didn't want to anymore, and I'd had a mission trip that was scheduled for the end of the semester, and I canceled it because I just didn't feel the purpose anymore in doing something like that, and I just wanted to go home. And I would experience these deep times of sadness, and when I would pray, I couldn't feel God the way that I felt him before, and I felt completely in the dark. And I began to question everything. If I didn't have my faith, then what did I have? What if that day in the desert when I was somewhat treated for a concussion, something worse happened to me? Is it possible to literally have your beliefs knocked out of you? My entire identity had been based on one thing. Everything I was and everything I did was based on serving Christ. And in that instant, that identity was gone. And people lose their faith all the time. Usually it's a very conscious decision. It's a rebellion to their upbringing, or it's something that happens that makes them question their reason for having a faith. And before I had pitied these people, but now, without notice or reason, I had been left alone by God, and I was scared. Before and after that day in the desert, everything had been the same, except that one thing that had been my everything. I would write in my blog, "Restore to us yourself, Lord. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry beyond measure with us." Lamentations 5, 21 through 22. That blog post was dated May 9th, 2011. And it would be the last blog post I ever wrote. Thank you.
Jody Oakley telling her story at the Monty, a nonprofit storytelling organization. Jeff Polish is the executive director and founder, and he's with me here. A unique story in the sense, and she points to it and says, this wasn't an angry rejection. This was losing the feeling of God, a kind of pointing to a biological root for her loss of faith.
It's incredible. I mean, you know, when you are injured or when you are in a traumatic accident, you can talk about losing limbs or, you know, losing some functionality. But she talks about losing her faith as if it is an appendage.
And wants it back.
And wants it back. But wanting it back is not enough.
So this is why conversations at the intersection of faith and medicine are so important, coming up at the Monty. And one of the storytellers participating in this Friday's Monty joins us now. Nana Kara McCracken is an OBGYN and a practitioner of the Sikh religion, and she joins us now. Nana, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell me a little bit. You grew up in India until you were 12 years old. Mm-hmm. What role did the Sikh faith play in your upbringing?
Yeah, so Frank, you know, we were a family that was very distinctive in the way we looked because my father wore a turban. So there was no denying that we were a Sikh family. And I would say that the way Sikhism played in our life was not in the way of active religious discourse. We weren't actually particularly a religious family. But what we had was living within the expansiveness and the equality that is such a big part of the Sikh religion. And, you know, the anecdote I have that I think best reflects that, or at least my earliest memory of this, was when I was about 6 years old. It was 1984. And Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India at the time, had just been assassinated by her Sikh guards over her decision to bomb the Golden Temple, which is the holiest of the Sikh shrine. My father at that time was a major in the Indian Army, and we were stationed in Mumbai. And it was a time of pretty awful violence against Sikhs. There were these Hindu mob uprisings, and they would pretty much go in and massacre Sikh families, and houses would get burned, and a lot of Sikhs were displaced at that within those months. And I remember having neighbors and friends around us who would make these very general statements about like these Hindus being these awful people who were doing this. And I remember always noticing that my parents would always say, this isn't about the Hindus. The Hindus aren't bad people. These are some people doing horrible, violent things who happen to be Hindu. And I think that played a very significant part in my upbringing.
And the story that you're going to tell this weekend involves your father. Maybe you could start by telling us about your relationship with your father.
Yeah, so I was very, very close to my father. We actually had the same birthday, which I found very significant and very exciting. You know, my father, I called him Papa, was just this very affable, likable, social, funny guy. And you know, I think that everyone who knew him, and there were a lot of people who he came across, always, like whenever I'm around them, and if they ever want to speak of my father, they always talk about how much he made them laugh or how kind he was.
So that's it. So maybe you can start by telling the story or give us a sense of the story that you're going to tell, which bears on the topic of the intersection of religion and medicine.
Yeah. So, you know, so my understanding of Sikhism was really quite limited outside of what I've talked about. And I have to say, you know, I rarely ever prayed, and when I prayed, the way I would describe my prayers would be transactional, where I would be in distress often because I had hurt myself yet again and needed stitches or fractured something, and I would be sitting in the emergency room asking God to make me better, and then I would, I don't know, be a better kid or something, or always listen to my parents. But apart from that, I didn't really know what to make of my religion. And then my father, about 4 years after we moved to the U.S., died fairly suddenly after a car accident. And the story really is about my father, about my relationship with him, about the events as they happened that night after the accident occurred, and then how I came to terms with what it really means to be a Sikh. Months after my father's death, after having this conversation one night with our Gyaniji, which is the Sikh priest of our Gurdwara.
We will find out more about that story, that transformation, and other conversations around the intersection and crossroads of medicine and religion when my conversation continues with Nana Kara McCracken, one of the storytellers featured in the upcoming Monty event about the intersection of religion and medicine. Jeff Polish, the founder and executive director of the Monty, and his co-teacher will join us as well on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about stories at the crossroads of medicine and religion, stories that are the subject of an event this Friday, co-hosted by the Museum of Life and Sciences, the Carolina Theater, and the Monty, a nonprofit storytelling organization. Still with me, Jeff Polish, the founder and executive director of the Monty, Nana Kara McCracken, an OBGYN, and a practicing Sikh who is participating in this Friday's event. So before the break, you were telling us about the story of your father, a very close relationship, and a terrible accident that he had that brought you in closer contact with your religion. So I'd like you to continue that story for us.
So, you know, what I felt after my father's death was a lot of anger and a lot of disconnection from this those subtle belief I'd had that there was divinity essentially all around us. And I really felt like, because I had prayed those 7 hours before my father died in a very transactional way, begging Waheguru, which is the Sikh term for this infinite light, for my father to be okay, that Waheguru had failed me. And that really there was no reason to pray anymore. And the night that I think the our Gyaniji saw this anger.
And who is that? Who is that again? Remind us.
So Gyani is the term for the Sikh priest. Okay. And we always add a G to it, which is just a term
honorific.
Of respect. Yeah,
yeah,
that's exactly right. I believe that our Gyaniji must have seen like the seething anger in me, which was really disconnecting me from my grief, and was kind enough to talk to me. And what he shared with me was the feelings he had had after the sudden death of his 8-year-old son while he was in India, and how he came to terms with Sikh teachings about life and about death in dealing with that.
So tell us what he told you. And how that affected you? Because again, I want everybody to sort of think about this moment you've given us. You are suffering. There's anger, a seething anger, as you've described it. It's not a time when most of us can be rational when someone is trying to talk us down. So I'm curious to know what it was that he said to you and how it affected you.
You know, I think at that moment in time, and the biggest way that it affected me is that it made me stop feeling so exclusive about my grief and about my loss. And you know, the teaching that he really offered me that night was the teaching of hukam, which is a very intrinsic part of the Sikh religion, and essentially it's the law of impermanence. This idea that that we are all at every moment in time engulfed in this infinite light and are actually bonded to it. And what separates us is this fictional mirage that we create as human beings with our egos and this sense of self that we have, that everything that we are is in this physical form, that we are unable to see that we are always connected to divinity. And that is true whether we are living or whether we are no longer living. And that essentially life and death are not these polar opposites, but they're completely fluid within this divine realm. And that he realized that that he was really no more connected to his son in death than he had been to him in life. And it really helped him feel free from this idea that his son was lost to him forever.
What do you think it was about that teaching that, because, you know, I'm guessing we've even heard that before, in that moment coming from him as it did, that made you see things differently?
You know, I think it made me, I think it was just that. I think it made me feel like perhaps my father had never been all mine to begin with.
I want to bring another practitioner in here, a doctor, a practicing doctor, and also a teacher in Christian philosophy. Dr. Ray Barfield is a professor of pediatrics, Christian philosophy. It teaches Christian philosophy at Duke and also directs the Pediatric Quality of Life and Palliative Care Program. Dr. Barfield, welcome back to the program. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Frank.
You were the one who's co-teaching with Jeff on this intersection of medicine and science, right?
That's right.
Well, tell us about this. How do you, as a practitioner, how does your journey as a doctor find its way into this question of how we talk to patients about their faith?
Well, my journey as a doctor went on for quite a while before I started understanding the importance of these ideas, this approach to patients. I was trained in a very traditional way, and as Jeff mentioned, spent most of my time thinking about the biology of disease, thinking about what normal biology should look like, thinking about what rogue biology looks like, and then trying to figure out ways to make rogue biology act more like normal biology. Or if the rogue biology was threatening to slow down and stop, to figure out ways to keep it moving, keep it going round and round. Over time, you know, I'm a pediatric oncologist, and we do pretty well now. We cure around 70% of the patients who come to us. But that means about 30% of the time, we don't have a cure. And we're going to have to talk about some different things, some things that we had hoped not to have to talk about. And as I listen to my patients and to their families talk about these kinds of things, the language of biology ended up being just too thin a gruel. This went way beyond the language of biology. And their decision-making went beyond the biology because the biology wouldn't tell you what the next right thing to do is. You had to find it somewhere else. And the more I listened, the more I began to realize that the language they were using was the language of storytelling, and very often religious storytelling, especially where I practice, which is in the Southeast. And I learned a lot from that.
Well, what do you do, though, when the language of storytelling and the language of religion, which almost by definition is in the context of the infinite, and almost by definition science is quite finite, it defines by definition. So you have an end of, you have a beginning and a middle and an end of life, and then you hear Nana talk about a continuum that we're all part of. And now you have a family in front of you talking about a continuum, and you're a scientist, and you say, well, yeah, until it ends. How do you have that conversation? What do you do?
Well, one thing is that if I say, yeah, until it ends, I'm not being a scientist because I'm going well beyond the evidence that I have access to. I'm saying things about a reality that I have not tested and that in principle I cannot test. And so I've stopped making scientific statements and started making philosophical and religious statements if I say, yeah, until it ends. So the first thing we have to do is get a little bit humble about what science is and about where its beauty lies and its usefulness.
I think you have a story about a woman you worked with in Kenya who informed some of your thinking on this topic, right?
I did. She was a surprise to me. Her name was Lydia. And I was the only attending physician at this small hospital in Maseno, which is a village in Kenya. She had come in. I had a resident with me from another medical school in the United States. And I had some medical officers who were trained in Kenya. They weren't physicians. Lydia came in, and she had a rapid heartbeat. She had a story of losing blood from her GI tract. She clearly was very sick. She was going to die fairly soon unless we did something. And the only something that we could do would be to give her blood. So we had her son take a blood sample off to another hospital, Kisumu, and bring back a couple of units of blood for her, which we gave her, brought her back into some safety. And through some history that I took from her, it was clear that she was bleeding from the upper part of her GI tract, and the bleeding episodes were becoming more frequent. And so I set up an opportunity for her to have a definitive GI scope, an intervention that would stop the bleeding. I was going to set her up for Friday. It was on Wednesday. And I told her I was excited that we were able to do this because there are not very many GI doctors in Kenya. And she looked at me and she said on Friday, Dr. Ray, I can't go. And I asked her why. And she said, well, I got a funeral. And my resident who was with me stepped towards her and said, well, what do you want, two funerals? Well, I asked her to hang on a second. And sat down and I asked Ms. Lydia why she needed to go to this funeral instead of getting this procedure that was potentially life-saving. And she said something really important. She said, Dr. Ray, when you're born, you know, if things go well, you have a wonderful life. But if things don't go well, if you've got your cord wrapped around your neck, your entire life can be ruined. And she said, it's the same way with dying. If the rituals that we do at funerals go well, the afterlife can go well for you. But if you don't do those well, the afterlife may not go well for you. And she said, Dr. Ray, also, if you are the one responsible for not doing the ritual well, you may be haunted for the rest of your life. Well, all of a sudden, I'm no longer thinking just in terms of high-output congestive heart failure and hemoglobins. I'm thinking about the possibility that she's weighing, which is that I might be haunted for the rest of my life and be responsible for ruining the afterlife for a person that I love. And those are high stakes.
What do you do as someone not raised in that tradition without that cultural, right, without that cultural truth? That's not your truth. It's her truth. It's not yours. And now you're faced with what the only thing you know, which is this surgery could save your life and Friday may be your last chance. In that moment, even though you've come to this deep understanding of why, what do you do knowing what you know and not sharing her cultural, that tradition?
Well, one thing that I do is to remember that I am a guest in her story, that she has invited me into her story. And so my agenda, the way that I view the world, the kind of decision that I would make, well, that's fine for my story, but I am there to listen to what she tells me about her world. And in her world, if she misses this, there's some consequences. And I need to take those as seriously as I would hope my doctor would take my own assessment of consequences seriously. When it's my turn.
Now, this really takes us back to your story to some extent, because when that priest was looking at you, again, he was not looking at biological pathologies. He was seeing rage that was, in your words, cutting you off from your own grief, a kind of diagnosis that he made in a way.
Yeah.
What did it do for you ultimately when you made that transformation, when you changed your mind? How did it change you? And does it change the way you act as a doctor and the way you see things as a doctor?
Yeah, you know, I think at that moment it freed me. It actually allowed me to access my sadness, my immense sadness over the loss of my father. And over the years, you know, I think every time you go through something significant like that in your life, and you're able to actually internalize it and think about it, it makes you better for it. And I think having lost someone so dear to me made me very conscious through my training and in my practice when people lose something, you know, even if I don't find it as significant, let's say, just because I haven't experienced it. And I found that to be true later on when my husband and I experienced a miscarriage. I felt like my understanding of what it's like to miscarry, my empathy towards it changed dramatically.
And Ray Barfield, it does seem to me that again, what that priest did in that moment is somewhat at odds with what we might do in Western medicine, where we would assume that the trauma of grief is something we want to cut you off because you've got enough trouble, and I don't want you to be otherwise upset because stress can lead to X, Y, and Z. Do we need to understand grief and sort of getting in touch with our emotions in a different way to be better practitioners?
Oh, we absolutely do. And I was trained with the language of boundaries, professional distance, these sorts of things. And for a long time, tried to sequester my emotional life from my work life. The problem is that, to be honest, I work a lot, and I don't spend a whole bunch of time awake at home. Most of my time that I'm at home, I'm asleep or doing email, which means that the majority of my conscious life, I'm at work. And so if I sequester my emotional life from my work life, I may very well end up with a shrunken emotional life because I'm not allowing my emotions to do the things that emotions need to do in human beings. I have discovered in my own practice, and this has been a part of the recovery of my practice and the enlivening of my practice, that to learn how to navigate the very real worlds of suffering and of illness and of dying, while also continuing to be fully a human being, which means a human being having an emotional life, that is the way that medicine and the practice of medicine becomes a spiritual adventure for the physician or for the physician's assistant or the nurse practitioner or the nurse, whoever is interacting with the patient. It becomes a very rich kind of experience. But I will tell you that that is something that, like everything else in medicine, requires a kind of mindful attention, requires practice, and it requires nurturing an imaginative response to the world rather than thinking that you already know where all the pieces are without remainder.
Jeff, in the few minutes that a few moments that I've given you, can you give us a brief summary of what we can expect beyond what we've just heard today at the storytelling on Friday?
Oh, it's a great show. We have a medical student, fourth year medical student, who's going to talk about his experience in the anatomy lab and how that challenged his faith. We're going to feature a woman who has been through a car accident when she was younger and how that impacted her for the rest of her life and in her search for understanding, and just more stories that really ask these questions. What does it all mean?
Jeff Polish, the founder and executive director of the Monty, Nana Kara McCracken, an OBGYN and practicing Sikh. Her story will be featured at the Monty, along with Dr. Ray Barfield, a professor of pediatrics, Christian philosophy at Duke University. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about the Monty at the museum. It's a co-hosted event, Museum of Life and Science, this Friday, November 3rd. All the details at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.